Wake up! Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. You are now listening to You and Me at 30. I'm your host, Dr. Joshua K. Wright. I realize that you could be anywhere in the world right now, but you're here listening to me, and I sincerely appreciate that. You and Me at 30 is a new talk show airing on Sunday mornings. I'll be bringing you lively, thought-provoking discussion on a variety of topics. Each show will feature an extended conversation with a guest. While many of these individuals will come from the University of Maryland Eastern Shore and the local community, I will also feature several guests from around the country. Please note that the views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of 91.3 WESM or the University of Maryland Eastern Shore. My guest this morning is Dr. Heidi Anderson. She assumed the presidency of UMES on September 1st, 2018, after acquiring nearly two decades of leadership experience in higher education. Dr. Anderson earned her PhD in pharmacy administration, a master's in education, and a bachelor's of science degree in pharmacy, all from Purdue University in West Lafayette, Indiana. The lineage of black female presidents can be traced back to Mary McLeod Bethune. In 1904, Mrs. Bethune founded the Daytona Normal and Industrial Institute for Negro Girls in Florida and oversaw its growth from five students to over 250. She served as its president for more than 20 years, during which she began merger proceedings with Cookman Institute. In 1925, the schools were officially linked, and by 1931, the merged institution was accredited and renamed Bethune-Cookman College in Daytona, Florida. Another pioneer in the college-university presidency was Dr. Anna Julia Cooper. Although many scholars in academia became familiar with the social justice work of Mrs. Cooper, she became president of Frelinghuysen University in 1930. For 20 years, the school provided access to higher education for Washington, D.C. residents. In 2001, Dr. Ruth Simmons became the first African-American woman appointed as president of an Ivy League institution when she took the helm at Brown University in Providence, Rhode Island. Overall, women are underrepresented among university presidents, and that number is even smaller for black women and women of color. Consequently, it's important that we highlight the work of figures like Bethune, Cookman, Simmons, and UMES's very own Dr. Anderson. President Anderson, thank you so much for joining me today.
Dr. Wright, it's a pleasure to be here today, and I didn't realize I was going to be in such company, in such historic company at that.
As we get started, I want to ask you, what does it mean to you to be a part of this lineage of these strong black female leaders in higher education?
It's an honor, it's humbling, and it's scary at the same time. So it's a really mixed bag of emotions.
What insights have you gained so far during your first 6 months here at UMES?
Well, first of all, UMES is a very beautiful campus. And for those listeners out there, if you haven't been to our campus, you need to get over here. But some of the insights I've gained, we're a campus that really believes in what I call the family approach. As they say, you know, you have to have a village to raise a child. Well, you also have to have a village to graduate a student. And what I mean by that is our staff, our faculty are all involved with having a student-centered approach. And that's one of the insights I have gleaned, is that we really do care about our students, and we really do care about getting them across that finish line as a team.
Can you tell us a little bit about your background? I gave you just a little bit of information, but if you could give us just a little more.
As you mentioned, I started in pharmacy, and I actually thought that I was going to own my own pharmacy one day. Mm. I wanted to be one of those people that did some cures to diabetes or something of that nature, but I soon got out of that realm and started thinking about an academic career and really wanting to give back and teach students in pharmacy. And I did that for a number of years and just loved it. But if you really want to make a difference, and one of the things I was concerned about was teaching students from disadvantaged areas and economically disadvantaged, and to do things and really make change, you really have to take the leadership helm. And so I started working then towards becoming a leader, from being department chair all the way through to being an associate assistant dean and vice presidency, and then started realizing, you know, the way to make real change for the future is really to step it up and take the top. So that's really a little bit about my background that you hadn't mentioned. The pharmacy is still my first love and, okay, and my roots. And from a disciplinary standpoint, it's one of those areas that can take you in a lot of different ways.
What's been your most significant accomplishment so far at UMES?
As president, I think my most significant accomplishment in the 6.5 months I've been here has been trying to get a stable leadership team. in any organization, it is so important to have a team of individuals who are there to help you fulfill the mission and the vision. And coming to UMES, there were several interim positions, and I had the opportunity to be able to search nationally for a number of members of my cabinet. So that was a really big challenge, but also one of the most significant accomplishments. Mm-hmm. I have a team in place now that I feel I can't be everywhere.
Right.
And so members of the team can be in different places and assist. Give you an example. Our students come from modest means, which means we need scholarships and we need money and we need resources for them. Mm-hmm. And some of our students are food insecure. And so we have to try to figure ways to supplement that, which means going out there getting scholarships. I'm out there doing my best to do that, but with having a good, solid leadership team, we can double up and be in multiple places at the same time.
And, you know, my next question, you kind of alluded to this a little bit, was in terms of challenges. You know, I know you talked about how there were several positions that needed to be filled. Was there anything else that was really pressing that you've experienced so far? And how have you gone about trying to find a solution to that?
Very, very good question, Dr. Wright. Definitely the most pressing thing at UMES when I arrived, and it's still here, and I think everyone on campus knows this, is our enrollment. It's been down for a number of years. I arrived and started trying to get familiar and get acquainted with members of the community in the Tri-County area. And what I learned, people thought that we had lost our accreditation. And I said, what led you to believe that? And because we lost an accredited program, mm-hmm. that made people have the wrong impression and feel like the entire university had lost its accreditation. And that was not true. So enrollment has been a big challenge. Mm-hmm. And in order to turn the enrollment around, you have to dispel the myths. And one of the things I learned through our social media, there was from the past, when you go back, there was a whole campaign that was like, oh, the university's losing accreditation. Don't go there. There's no quality. But we have the finest quality faculty and staff. And so that's one thing I've been going around as I talk to audiences. I say, please, that is not true about our campus. Mm-hmm. We have a number of accredited programs. And when you lose one, doesn't mean it's a domino effect onto the others. If I can say one more thing on the enrollment, because that is such a challenge, we have really pulled together and we are launching a focused strategic enrollment plan. And once that plan gets into place, people will begin to see this enrollment will turn around. And I don't want to put numbers on it, but be watching out for it.
In terms of enrollment, just for our listeners who may not be as familiar with the campus and with UMES, where do the majority of the students come from?
Believe it or not, our students are from every county in the state of Maryland. And I would say, and I hope I have my numbers correctly here, is about 80% of our students are from the state, inside the state.
Okay.
And of course, we pull students from Virginia and we pull students from Delaware, the other surrounding areas. A few of them will come from out of state, but the majority are right here in the state of Maryland, and they tend to go back to those counties when they leave.
And you talked about community relations. Are many of the students also coming from Princess Anne or some of these, you know, nearby cities in particular?
We have students coming from Somerset County, Wacomico, as well as Worcester. So our students are pulled from each one of those. Give you an example. One of our alums, which I always like to give a shout out to, is the current Maryland State Teacher of the Year, Dr. Richard Warren. And he's a three-time UMES graduate, so we're very proud of him. But right here, and I mention him simply because he teaches as a teacher now in Crisfield. So you can imagine, having been a three-time alum, he's probably going to send students over here from Crisfield.
Yeah, and I think that is so important that, you know, for all universities that they are active in those local communities, just because, you know, you don't want the people in the towns thinking that you have these outsiders coming from all different parts of the state and all different parts of the country. And then, you know, they're not doing anything to actually enrich or give back to those local communities.
Very important. I can tell you, after having spent a number of weeks and visits over to our legislators this session while they were in, and I went over to Annapolis several times, any state that you're in, your legislatures want to know that the students that you're recruiting are majority from your state. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't mean that you're not going to look at students from other places, you know. But that's just to give back, like you say, to those communities and the economic development. That's very important.
For the past 12 years, UMES, Morgan State, Bowie State, and Coppin State have a court case against the state of Maryland over inadequate funding for the state's historically black colleges and universities, also known as HBCUs.
Mm-hmm.
What do you say to critics who argue that HBCUs are no longer needed in 2019 as they were in years past during Jim Crow and segregation?
That is not true. Mm-hmm. That's what I say to critics. But let me elaborate on that. HBCUs produce the most African-American doctors, lawyers, pharmacists, health professionals, scientists, need I go on? Actors, performers, than any other institution. And that's going to continue. But more importantly, many of your HBCUs are a land-grant institution like we are. We're in 1890s. For our listeners out there, what that means is that the land-grant mission came with a dual role, to educate tomorrow's teachers, but also to help in the communities, and especially those areas of agriculture and science. And that means having a partnership with your communities and helping to find solutions to communities' problems. HBCUs are critical in that area. And let's talk about UMES. We're doing research in areas that deals with the water, marine research, soil research, research that can help find cures for things like diabetes. And when you think about also HBCUs, those students out there or patients in the future, they want to see someone who looks like them. So these universities are so important and so valuable, and still they're valuable. Now, are we going to continue with the models of how the universities were in 1890 or 1800s? No, just like everything else, we have to evolve.
You know, as a young college professor, I think I relate with my students pretty well just because I don't look too much older than some of them.
I think you do. I've heard you did.
And a lot of my students tend to be between the ages of 18 and 20. Some are a little older, but you know, they're growing up in this time period of social media, right? And, you know, when you look on social media and also just the media in general, you see so many people who are, they seem to be getting rich quick almost, right? Mm-hmm. And you hear a lot about people. And in fact, I was watching a documentary earlier this morning. You hear about these people who have made it big and they never attended college, right? And my question is, how valuable is a college degree today? Obviously, you know, we've heard the arguments that, well, a bachelor's degree is the equivalent of a high school diploma. We hear that argument. Mm-hmm. But then we also hear this argument that, well, you know, you could get by with just 1 or 2 years of college, if any, and you could still be successful. So as a university president, what would your answer be to that? How much do we need a college degree?
I think that's a very good question. And it's one that our listeners out there, we really need to kind of instill in them, that a lot of reasons. First of all, people with a college degree, they have a different way of thinking, mm-hmm. critical thinking. They have a different way of solving problems out there. And something else that employers are looking for is teamwork. They know how to work in teams in a little different way than people without a college degree. Now, that's just the beginning. That's just the tip of the iceberg, because obviously with the college degree, the people are going to earn more. You mentioned people out there who have no degree who basically have made it big. Well, that's in the minority. Those numbers are in the minority compared to the rest of the population. Going forward, what the research and the data is showing is that we are going to have machines doing artificial intelligence, doing virtual reality, and those machines and the work that people used to do is not going to exist. It's going to be more with machines, smart machines. Those with college degrees will come out having a better handle on how to handle those kind of work areas. It'll be very different than when we used to have just manufacturing, and people could take a job and maybe stay there for the rest of their life straight out of high school and make a lot of money. Very, very different going forward. So that's what I would say, is that people have to realize that a college degree provides you with a set of lifelong learning skills that you know how to package and repackage to take you into a number of places. I would like to say at UMES, the degrees that we offer, they really have impact on the economic development of the region as well.
And when students are choosing degrees, that's also a really big topic now as well, because there's so much of an emphasis on STEM fields, right? And things dealing with computers, electronics, because, you know, you hear that's where the good jobs are in terms of making money. And, you know, there's less emphasis placed on some of the other majors in humanities and things like that that they would have been in the past years. So, and also education. And I'm bringing this up because you mentioned Dr. Richard Warren, who's going to be appearing on our show in a few weeks. But I had a conversation with Dr. Warren and some other educators, and we were talking about, well, should people still go into teaching? Because, you know, we hear about the pay being so low, and then you have student loans. So again, how would you advise a young person right now who's going to be attending college soon, and they're thinking about, well, which major and which career path should I take?
That's almost two questions there, but let me start with the latter. I would advise a young person who's looking to go to college to go into something that you that you believe you love, mm-hmm. because if you don't like it, you're not going to stick with it. You're not going to be committed. Mm-hmm. The second part of that, though, is teachers. Correct. Teachers get the lowest pay, and I think we as a society need to really step back and say, what do we value? Because teachers, they spend more hours with our young children, with our young kids, than any other profession. But yet we don't pay them enough. And I think as a society, we need to group together and we need to advocate to our legislatures and to others that we need to change that model. You know, other countries have looked at that and done that in the past. They recognize that teaching is a noble profession and that teachers need to be paid. I think we have to have teachers, and what we can do in higher ed is we need to partnership. We have better partnerships from what we call P20 all the way through, and have those pipelines of how we connect.
Ladies and gentlemen, you are listening to UMES 30. Today's guest is Dr. Heidi Anderson, the 16th president of the University of Maryland Eastern Shore. So Dr. Anderson, you are a proud native of Gary, Indiana. So, you know, Gary is a very interesting place. Okay, it's the home of the Jackson Five. You know, on March 10th, 1972, you had 8,000 African Americans from across the nation who descended upon the city for the inaugural National Black Political Convention, which was a 3-day event dedicated to creating solutions to problems facing blacks nationwide. And the event was hosted by Richard Hatcher, the mayor. And in 1967, Mayor Hatcher became one of the first two black mayors of any major American city. My question is, how did growing up in a place like Gary shape your childhood and also the woman that you would eventually become?
Interesting. Well, first of all, I want to say that I did not know Michael Jackson. I always have to tell people that because I get that a lot. Did you know the Jacksons? And no. And I don't know how to sing the song to the Music Man either. But let me respond directly. Gary is an interesting place, and it also was a challenging place. And to grow up in Gary, Indiana, Gary was a really tough place to grow up in because you're looking at drugs and poverty as well as violence in that city. And so, and I can tell you, in my family, my mom was real concerned about that. We grew up kind of sheltered, and because you didn't want to get caught up into all of that. So what I learned and what Gary influenced me is I grew up tough in a tough environment. I learned how to be tough. But people don't want to see toughness walking in the door, so you have to kind of mold that and shape it into being a little bit softer approach. So I would say Gary taught me how to survive and taught me really how to trust my instincts. You know, at one time it was a place where you want to be careful walking down the street. You may, you know, get mugged. And so it taught you how to keep your antennas up, so to say, and watch your environment very, very carefully.
Who were some of your role models growing up?
I had role models in school all throughout. So I can remember in elementary school, there was Miss Smith who encouraged and said, you know, hey, you got to think about going to school, think about going to college. Then there was Miss Sadie Shropshire in high school. I hated English, and probably because of her, Miss Shropshire. But she really instilled that you have to learn how to write the word and speak it as well. Then move on to Purdue University, where I went, did all of my degrees, and I had several professors there who were very instrumental in mentoring me to not only get the grades, but also become a well-rounded, holistic type of individual. And when I started advancing into the academic administration world, I can think of people like my best and favorite mentor, Joan, and how she's there, you know, kind of, you know, in my ear, you know, do it this way, think of it that way, or don't forget about this particular aspect. So quite a few different mentors throughout my life. And I think I was grounded, and of course grounded with my mother's mentoring. So that was kind of a framework that I came out with.
Did you come from a family that, you know, went pretty far in terms of education?
Not at all. I'm the first generation. I'm a first generation. So the first in the family to go to college. Okay. My mother was educated through high school as well as my dad, but none of them. And my mom actually went to college after I started in pharmacy at Purdue. She went back and got through. And I kind of thought that was very, very impressive of her.
When did you know you wanted to get a PhD?
When I first went to pharmacy class and I didn't like how they were teaching. And those professors at Purdue would remember that. I was kind of rebellistic at times, but it was like, you're teaching me in a way that is not adequate to learn. And I'm thinking, how can I change this? Well, one of the ways to change is to you go ahead and get advanced degrees so you can become the teacher. You can, you know, you instead of just talking the talk, you preach it, you walk it, et cetera. Right. And I first thought just a master's would do it, but once I got a master's, then I realized if I want to become a professor and really change things inside the academy, a PhD was the ticket to open that door.
As a young Black woman coming from Gary, which is a majority Black, and then you go into Purdue, which is not majority black.
Not at all.
So my question is, it's actually a two-part question. For you, what was that transition like? Like, how were you able to adjust? And then also, when you're talking to students now at UMES who are at HBCU, and a lot of them may come from Black schools and Black communities, and one day they're going to go off and they may be working in environments where they may be the only person who looks like them. You know, like, how do you kind of relate your own personal story to kind of give them some advice on what to do?
Good question. First of all, I think that I'd like to say, coming up in Gary, I actually wanted to attend an HBCU, but we couldn't afford it. My mom raised us alone, and we really could not afford the education. So I had to go to some school in the state, and I got a scholarship, you know, and some grants to go to Purdue. It was a culture shock. But it was one of the things I think my mother grounded me on in is really knowing who I am and being comfortable in my own skin. And Purdue was the first time I had left home and went there. And it was amazing to see, wow, a sea of people who did not look like me. Mm-hmm. So what I say to students is you have to get very, very comfortable with who you are. Be confident in who you are. And, you know, and draw on your faith as well. And, you know, but you ground yourself in your values and your beliefs and your moral compass. And that takes you anywhere. And if you allow yourself to do that, and even when you're the only, and I've been the only one in a number of instances, not just in my classes at Purdue, but when I became a professor, assistant professor, associate professor, full professor, I was the only Black, and I think the only one, yes, only Black professor in several places and the only woman, Black female as well.
On that note about being the only one, though, right, the only Black, the only woman, do you support that notion about having to be twice as good when you're a minority, or do you feel as though that puts an unnecessary burden on kids? Because I've heard Ta-Nehisi Coates, the acclaimed writer, say that he doesn't really buy into that because he thinks that's an unfair burden to put on kids. Always say you have to be twice and three times as good if you want to survive and make it.
And he may not buy into it, but it actually is true. And okay. It's not twice as good when you're a woman. It's three times as good.
So, Dr. Anderson, you have an extremely busy life. What are some things you do for self-care and relaxation?
Self-care, what's that? No, just kidding. Some of the things I love to do, I love reading, and I read a variety of different things. But one, I do like playing golf. Okay. I have not, people will say, has she been out on the golf course since she's been here? I have not been out and been able to play a full game since I've been here. I was on one fundraising event, and that turned out to be a really good event that day. But the other things I like to do is exercise and used to be exercising daily. Since I've been in this particular new role, I'm lucky if I can get 3 days in a week, but that's really what I try to do. Okay. And then my husband and I, we love to travel. Oh, and I forgot about the NBA games. We are such NBA sports fans.
Oh, really?
Our bucket list is to see all of the NBA teams live before we die, of course. And right now we're halfway through that list. So we're kind of thrilled with that, and one of my favorite teams is the Spurs. Okay. I probably have seen them about half a dozen times.
social media, we discussed this a little earlier, but social media is very significant today in terms of how we communicate and how we express ourselves and our feelings. How much of a voice do you want UMES students and faculty to have on social media?
Dr. Wright, that's an excellent question. I want our faculty and our students and our staff to have a strong voice on social media. But for our students, I want them to have a careful voice on social media. And let me explain what I mean by that. Social media follows you everywhere. And this generation, your generation, I think it is, are used to posting and talking about, you know, telling people where they're at every second of the day. But you have to be careful with what you put on social media because it can last and it stays there forever. I have seen young men and women who do not get lose a job because they didn't see what was posted and who they're friending, you know, and all that information. So I think we have to always evolve with whatever communication strategy is out there, but we also have to know how to be careful with it as well.
And my final question is a two-parter. The first part, what is your vision for UMES in these next 5 years?
Obviously, my first part of that vision is to grow our enrollment. But as I have told the campus, and I'm telling anyone when I'm talking out there, we are a top 20 HBCU, and we have been in the top 20s for a number of years. My vision is to move us into a top 10 HBCU.
And then my second part, why should a high school senior or an aspiring graduate student enroll at UMES next fall?
Seniors, high school students, we have a beautiful campus. We have a class size that is very small, a small number of instructors to student body size. We have a very well-rounded student body and a world-class group of faculty and staff because we are a research institution as well. And unique academic programs. Where can you go to major in something like aviation sciences? Our certified PGA golf management program, which is only one of 18 in the country, or programs like our health professions, agriculture and sciences. That's why you should enroll at UMES. And the last point is we care about you.
Hawk pride.
Catch it.
President Anderson, thank you so much for being with us this morning.
Thank you very much for having me, and I look forward to the next time.
We end each show with a segment called Parting Shots. Here's when I give my thoughts on something happening in the news, pop culture, or life in general that's piqued my interest. April 4th was the 51st anniversary of the death of Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. Dr. King is best known for his 1963 I Have a Dream speech delivered at the March on Washington. But he also spoke out against poverty and economic inequality. He went to Chicago just 2 years before his death to fight housing discrimination. Many Americans turned against Dr. King in 1967 when he spoke out against the U.S. involvement in the controversial Vietnam War. He delivered some of history's most memorable speeches, such as The Drum Major's Instinct and I've Been to the Mountaintop. HBO is currently airing a new documentary on the final years of King's life, titled King in the Wilderness. If you don't subscribe to HBO, you can watch the film for free on internet by going to YouTube. And I would definitely encourage anyone, whether you're a teacher or just someone who wants to learn more about Dr. King, to watch this important film. And that's our show for the week. Thanks again to our guest today, President Heidi Anderson of UMES. We do this every Sunday at 10:30 a.m. If you like the show, please tell your friends about it. Like us on Facebook and other forms of social media. A special shout out, as always, to Uncle Phil and Aunt Viv. Have a blessed day.